All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, February 21st, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is an unbelievable 64 degrees. Yes, you heard it. And about ready to pour with rain here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Friday? That was the last live show. We titled the show Biological versus Digital, Brains, Amazon Medical, and Forever IoT Secrets. And we looked at a bunch of different things. We have this Amazon healthcare plan that is marching forward with Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, and Warren Buffett all working together, not only to provide their, I don't know, it was like a million employees. And maybe it wasn't that many, but it was a lot. Employees' health care at a reasonable cost, but they also are looking at working with drug manufacturers to be able to deliver prescriptions, maybe even with hospitals, to do a supply chain like sell things such as hip replacements, which is kind of crazy. We also looked at some of the 3D printing and putting 3D printers on the blockchain. There's a new startup who is talking about doing that. And then we found out about Georgie Porgy Church wanting to give you the opportunity to get your DNA sequenced and then sell that on the blockchain. So at some point in the future, you might be able to have the ability to have your doctor print you 3D stem cell organs on demand that won't have any rejection issues. Well, that is where we're going to continue today. I want to just back up 1 second. So I ran a rebroad Monday and Tuesday. The one I ran yesterday was titled Clones, Neurodust, DARPA, and Brain Surveillance in Schools. And I want to get to the cloning piece of this because we talked about clones and clones being approved back in 2008 to be on the market. When they asked the USDA as to whether or not we were consuming them, they said, well, we don't quite know. But don't worry about it because you don't need to have labels on them because they have been proven to be biologically equivalent, just like some of the GMOs are, to the original. So you don't need to worry your pretty little heads about it. Well, I ran across a couple stories. Now, this one is from 2017, but I thought it was a good precursor because it had to do with the University of California, Davis, where Jennifer Doudna is and where they have had a cow project going on for quite some time. And I don't remember if they were cloning. I think they were cloning and then genetically modifying these cows. And they had been longhorn cows, but they were trying to make their horns shorter so they could pack more of them into a freight car. Now, come on, guys. Like, when we start talking about some of this experimentation that's going on, you really have to question, like, where humanity is. Because this is really beginning to bother me quite extensively. Every single day, we see them doing horrible things to these little creatures. Things that, you know, if they had their choice, if they had their say, they wouldn't be signing up for, just like you shouldn't be signing up for. Some of this mad science we talk about is putting us in the same position as these cows or these pigs that we're going to talk about here in a minute, where they are experimenting on us. And as this Internet of Things rolls out, these wearables, 24/7 connectivity, to be able to monitor, bag, and tag everything about you, they'll be able to have you like a rat in a cage. And I think we looked at one of those kits one time, the lab kits that you can buy to monitor your entire environment of your lab rat, including the heat and the humidity and all of his actions and how much he's eating and pooping, to be able to gauge results from your experiments. Well, that's what the Internet of Things is going to do to us. It's going to be able to measure our environmental factors as well as our biological factors ad nauseum so they can draw conclusive results and get a dashboard of their experiments. Well, anyway, this is out of Stat News, October 20th, 2017. Near the campus cow pasture, those are those cows I was telling you about. A scientist works to grow human organs in pigs. And hey, this is not Georgie Porgy Church. This is another one of the CRISPR team on the other coast. though those two teams don't get along very well, but they were co-creators of CRISPR. Like many of the scientists who help usher in the groundbreaking creation of a part-human, part-animal chimera earlier this year, biologist Dr. Pablo Juan Ross is no stranger to cutting-edge tools such as CRISPR and stem cells. But he also knows his way around the inside of a pig uterus. Well, good for him. So while growing human cells inside of fetal pigs involved some of the science's fanciest new tricks, it also required something decidedly more mundane, and that would be a farm stocked with livestock and staffed with people like Ross who know how to handle them. Trained as a veterinarian and animal scientist, Ross works at the University of California, Davis, where hay is piled two stories high on Dairy Road. And there are signs that read, and this is what was frightening, quote-unquote, meat sales today. Oh, so are they really selling transgenic cow meat or cloned cow meat to unsuspecting passersby? And cows graze next to the soccer fields, and the swine facility is filled with squealing black and white Hampshire piglets, and they also have their own Facebook page. Without Ross and his deep understanding of the peculiarities of various livestock species and their embryos, the daunting chimera experiments might not have ever been possible. He was indispensable, says Jun Wu, a human stem cell expert at the Salk Institute, the place that created the polio vaccine, who found himself in the unlikely position of helping hoist a 200-pound sow onto an operating table during one of his visits here to work with Ross. The experiments, led by Wu and his Salk colleagues Juan Carlos Ibzuza Belmonte, published in January, and was hailed as a tremendous accomplishment and the first ever creation of organisms that were part human, part animal, represents a huge and hopeful step in the quest to grow human organs for transplant. I'm still questioning the scientific validity of all of this. If we can use stem cells and coax them to turn into any type of stem cell in the body just by a few scrapings from your skin, mixing them up with a little chemical cocktail, and then 3D printing them on scaffolds that come from high-res 3D imaging of your organs, they can use a stem cell printer and make those organs. What? You know, mixing pigs and humans or cows and humans, or we're going to soon find out, brand new experiment, sheep and humans to grow organs that then we can cut out of that living organism that has grown to depend on that human-esque organ. So that creature can then die so you can live. Where is the humanity? For any of us who have pets, I think you understand. You know, these little creatures all have little personalities, even down to little lizards. I had a lizard. His name was Billy. He was very cute. He used to like to dance to music and play hide and go seek inside of my tent behind a blanket. But all these little creatures have personalities. So what right do you have to potentially... I mean, God forbid those little mice that we were looking at where they were implanting the mini brain balls into their skulls. And the neurological connections as well as the vasculature all automatically connected. So these mice had these human mini brain balls inside of them. I mean, what happens if they start to become somewhat humanized? Then what? What if it starts talking? So do you kill it? You get out the shovel? I don't know. It's pretty horrifying. So anyway, but the goal remains far out of reach. These chimeras are just now containing a tiny fraction of human cells, maybe 1 in 100,000, which is leaving the creators grappling to find ways to boost the proportion of human cells, oh no, in their chimeras to useful levels. Ross is doing what he can with limited funding to puzzle out the animal side of the equation. His expertise is so in demand. Oh, no, my daughter says she wanted to become a veterinarian. Maybe she'd become a veterinarian, mad scientist, biologist. Ross has also been recruited by the Salk's main rival, Stanford University's Dr. Hiromishito Nakatsuchi, who broke open the chimera field with his 2010 experiment showing that he could grow a rat's pancreas in a mouse, and then followed it up with subsequent experiments showing mice could be cured of diabetes using chimeric mouse pancreases grown in rats. Nakatsuchi is now working with Ross on human sheep chimeras, hoping that sheep, which have proven more receptive than pigs for growing human blood cells, might be a better template for growing human organs. And that is where we're going to jump off the story that goes on and on and on and on and on about chimeras and other horrors to this brand new story that came out. There is no date nearby. Oh, February 17th, 2018, so just 4 days ago. This is out of The Guardian. Breakthrough as scientists grow sheep embryos containing human cells. Growing human organs inside of other animals has taken us another step away from science fiction. So back away slowly. With researchers announcing that they have grown sheep embryos containing human cells. Scientists say growing human organs inside of animals could not only increase the supply, but also offer the possibility of genetically tailoring the organs to be compatible with the immune systems of the patient receiving them, and by using the patient's own cells in the procedure, removing the possibility of rejection. I'm going to warn you guys, by the way, I'm recovering from the flu. I got hit like a truck this weekend, and it now has moved into my chest, so if I have to all of a sudden put on the cough button for a second and go blank, you'll know why. Scientists say also growing human organs inside of animals can increase supply, and according to the NHS Blood and Transplant Institute, there are almost 460 people who died in 2016 waiting for organs, while those who didn't receive transplants or who did receive transplants sometimes see the organs rejected. And even today, the best matched organs, except if they come from identical twins, and we found that out a couple days ago in a story, don't last very long because with time, the immune system continuously is attacking them, and so they have to take anti-rejection drugs for typically the rest of their lives. Excuse me for that one. So, as for the rest of their lives, says Dr. Pablo Ross, and this is the same Ross from that last story we read, of the University of California, Davis, who was part of the team working toward growing human organs in other species. Ross added that if it does become possible to grow human organs inside of other species, it might be that organ transplants become a possibility beyond critical conditions. And Bruce Whitelaw, a professor of animal biotechnology at the Roslin Institute, where Dolly the sheep was created, says that while, and that was the very first clone, that while there was a very long way to go before human organs could be grown in other animals, the latest research is an important step forward through starting to explore whether sheep offered an option for this exciting chimeric project. The approach is different to xenotransplantation, in which an organ that belongs to another species is transplanted into humans. While that is another possibility for tackling the dearth of organs, rejection would still be a problem, and attempts by scientists to grow organs from one species inside of another is an ongoing mission. Among previous efforts, scientists have grown a rat's pancreas inside of a mouse, like we already heard about, but Ross and his colleagues have recently reported a major breakthrough for their own species, revealing that they were able to introduce human stem cells into early pig embryos, producing embryos for which about one in every 100,000 cells were human. And these chimeras, a term adapted from Greek mythology, were only allowed to develop for 28 days. Whew. But now, at this week's meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Austin, Texas, a team has announced that they have managed a similar feat with sheep embryos and achieved an even higher ratio, which is what he was hoping for, of human to animal cells. About 1 in 10,000 cells in these sheep embryos are human, says Ross, and the team says that they have already been able to use genome editing techniques to produce pig and sheep embryos that are unable to develop a pancreas, although they are still working on the approach. And the hope is that human cells introduced into such embryos would grow the replacement organ that is missing. The team is currently allowed to let the chimeric embryos develop for 28 days, 21 of which are inside of the sheep. And while that might not, while that might be sufficient to see the development of a missing organ when human cells are eventually combined with the genetically modified embryo, Dr. Hiro Nakauchi of Stanford University, who is part of this team, says a longer experiment, oh no, like those mini brain balls that were allowed to grow for a few years, perhaps up to 70 days, he says, would be more convincing, although it would require additional permission from institutional review boards. But Ross says, for the approach to work, it is thought that about 1% of the embryo cells would have to be human, meaning further work is needed to increase the proportion of human cells in the chimera. Oh, no. They're going to all be sitting around a table smoking cigarettes, playing poker one night. Ross added that there are several advantages to using sheep embryos, including that they can be produced by IVF and that fewer embryos are needed to transplant into an adult, meaning fewer embryos are needed for an experiment. For a pig, we typically need to transfer 50 embryos into one recipient, and with the sheep, we transfer 4 embryos into one recipient. Sheep also have certain organs, such as heart and lungs, that are similar to ours, and their embryos have shown to form chimeras with goat embryos to produce geeps. That's the first I've heard of a geep. Like pigs, sheep produce organs of about the right size for the human body, and researching with pigs is continuing, says Ross, noting that they have other benefits, including speed of growth and the ability to produce more young at a time than sheep, meaning fewer animals are needed to produce more data. But of course, ethical concerns abound. Yeah, it sure sounds like it. Not least of which, could a chimera end up with a human-like mind? Well, Ross says, I have the same concerns. That should be concerning to you. Adding that the team is also looking at where these human cells are ending up in the chimeras. Well, let's say that if our results indicate that the human cells all go to the brain of the animal, then maybe we never carry this forward, he says, and we end up killing what we have, though he didn't say that, but that's what they'd have to do. Nakauchi is optimistic that humans will eventually be able to retrieve organs grown in animals. It could take 5 years or it could take 10, but I think eventually we will be able to do this, he says. Nakauchi also played down concerns, quote, the contribution of human cells so far is very small. It's nothing like a pig with a human face or a human brain, he says. We have published several papers showing that we can target the region and we can avoid human cells from differentiating into the human brain or the human gonads. Other potential issues include that viruses within the DNA of the host can infect the human cells. Yeah, but don't worry about it because Georgie Porgy Church got rid of that in pigs with CRISPR and by CRISPRing out the pig diseases. So when they grew the chimeric organs, they wouldn't have any of the pig diseases. The organs could not then be used for transplant into humans without triggering the immune system to reject them, and this would be very fast rejection. However, recent developments in gene editing have allowed scientists to develop piglets without such viruses, ding ding, potentially smoothing the way, while Ross notes that human cells might replace any remaining host cells after the transplantation. Currently, the U.S. National Institute of Health has a moratorium on funding such research, but it is looking to lift this moratorium and replace it with a review process. And in the U.K., scientists must apply to the Home Office for a license to carry out such research. Well, damn good thing. So we covered a few stories about the 3D printing of living cells. And this brand new story was about 3D air printing microfluidics of stem cells without even, I don't even think it had an actual scaffold. It was printing them in the air and then using jets, and they were fusing together using a new technique they call in-air microfluidics University of Twente scientists succeed in printing 3D structures with living cells. And in a special technique, it enables a very fast on-the-fly production of micro building blocks that are viable and can be used for repairing damaged tissue. Microfluidics is all about manipulating tiny drops of fluid with sizes between a micrometer and a millimeter. And most often, chips with tiny microfluidic channels, reactors, and other components are used for this. Those would be those lab-on-a-chip systems. And although these, which DARPA's working on, we're going to talk about the one that can smell now in a few minutes. Most often, chips with tiny fluidic channels, reactors, and other components, these labs-on-a-chip, they have speeds at which these droplets leave the chip, and it's typically a microliter per minute range. And for clinical and industrial applications, it is not fast enough. So now this new technique that is being presented now, this in-air microfluidics, can do this in a couple of minutes. So we reach these higher speeds by not manipulating the fluids into microchannels, but into air instead. It was one of the questions researchers wanted to answer, and it was indeed possible. From one jet, droplets are shot at another jet, and creating the jets is relatively simple. They just move 100 to 1,000 times faster than droplets in a microchip. And by choosing jets containing different types of fluids that react together, the collision results in new materials. And these smart combinations of fluids will result in solid, imprintable building blocks in just one single step. So the resulting bio-building blocks are printed in a 3D structure that looks just like a sponge filled with cells and a fluid. And these 3D module biomaterials have an internal structure that is quite near similar to that of natural tissue. Many 3D printing techniques are based on using heat or UV, but both damage living cells. These new microfluidic approaches are therefore a promising technique in tissue engineering in which damaged tissue is repaired by using cultured cell materials of the patient. Take another step forward, because we also touched on this one. Soon your doctor could print a human organ on demand. That's what I'm saying. I mean, we are doing all this research in 3D printing of stem cells and organs and microfluidic in-air printing of replacement cells. Why would we need to create human-animal chimeras? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Why even put those poor animals through the misery and create these abominations that do not belong? I mean, that's why they cannot reproduce naturally as a part of nature, because it's not supposed to be happening. All right, so this is where we started on Friday at the very end of the show, and I want to continue from here. It took me all this time to get up to this point, 25 minutes. A few years ago, so this is titled, "This Amazing Computer Chip is Made of Live Brain Cells." This was March 17th, 2016, and we actually read a follow-up to this story a couple days ago about the guy Kanuku, the Kanuku Corps, who was, he was in South Africa creating some sort of brain ability to smell on a chip. But this was from 2016 out of SingularityHub.com. A few years ago, researchers from Germany and Japan were able to simulate 1% of the human brain activity for a single second. Yeah, well, not anymore. And it took the processing power of one of the world's most powerful supercomputers to make that happen. Well, now it's been an exponential growth of supercomputers since that time. In neuromorphic systems on a chip, hands down, the human brain is by far the most powerful, energy-efficient computer ever created. But remember, they just created artificial synapses that can fire a billion times a second and are more low-power than human synapses. So put on a seatbelt. So what if we could harness the power of the human brain by using actual brain cells to power the next generation of computers? Well, as crazy as it sounds, that is exactly what neuroscientist Osh Agabadi is doing. Kanuku, which is Agabadi's startup, has developed a prototype 64-neuron silicon chip. And its first application? Well, he is going to create a drone. Yes, a drone that can smell explosives. Oh, they left that one out of the story that we had read. So this is a drone with a bee's sense of smell, and we read about the bees. That was an experiment that DARPA had funded for Los Alamos or one of those federal laboratories where they had, and I'd watched a video on it, they taped these little bees again. Like, what on earth are they doing? That my heart just goes out when I see these little creatures because I get so sad. They had taped these little bees that were struggling, of course, inside of these little, I don't know, harnesses. So all that was sticking out was the bee's little head, and then they put them inside a box that was all encased in plexiglass, and then walked them around people and vehicles that have been exposed to C4 to see if they would react to it, and they had discovered that the bees reacted to explosives. But that experiment failed. I don't know if they lost funding or whatever, but that experiment ended up not going anywhere. They had written extensively about it, that Annie Jacobson had written extensively about it in the DARPA, the Pentagon's Brain book. And that's where I read about it. And then on YouTube, there was a video. But anyway, a bee can navigate incredibly well because of its powerful ability to detect and interpret smells. And Agabadi was fascinated by this and wondered, what if we could extract just the part responsible for that in a bee and put it in a drone? Oh no, did he take this out of the bee and not mini brain balls? Because we found out also that when they were growing mini brain balls out of human stem cells, that when they let them grow unfettered for a long period of time, they started to differentiate into different types of brain cells. One of those happened to be the olfactory section of the brain. That would be the section that smells, though I don't think there's too many humans that can walk around sniffing like a dog or a bee. Such a drone would be able to smell bombs several kilometers away, says Agabadi, and it could also be used for surveying farmlands, refineries, and manufacturing plants. Almost anything where health and safety can be measured by an acute sense of smell. Maybe even the FDA could use it for sniffing out Corexit on, seafood out of the Gulf of Mexico. Remember, they were hiring super sniffers to approve the seafood. Well, there are no silicon devices currently which are able to give us this level of sensitivity that we find in biology. So look out. So how does Kanoko chip actually work? Well, let's dig into it. Baby steps toward biological computing. To create his first working prototype, Agabadi and his team had to solve three big problems. They had to learn to, one, structure neurons in the same way they are structured in our brains. Number two, read and write information into a single neuron. And then number three, create an environment to keep our neurons stable. Using induced pluripotent stem cell technology, and those would be the scraped off the skin iPS stem cells, the same ones they make the mini brain balls from. This method, in which adult cells from the skin, for example, are genetically reprogrammed into stem cells, any cell can be turned into a neuron and then a mini brain ball. But what you do once you have a living neuron, well, like electronic components, live cells need a specific environment to be able to operate. So by creating a special shell for each neuron, the Kanoko team is able to control the temperature and the pH level that can also send nutrients to these neurons to keep them alive. So they are enslaving human stem cells, human neurons. They are also able to control how the neurons communicate with each other within these shells. And this would probably be more like a brain on a chip. And an electrode under the shell enables the information to be read and written into these neurons. And Agabadi describes the process like this. We coat the electrodes with DNA and enrich the protein, which encourages the neurons to form an artificial tight junction with the electrodes. And in that way, which encourages, not forces, encourages. That way we can read the information from the neurons and we can write the information into the neurons using the same electrodes or other means, i.e. light or chemical. Oh, guys, this is so bad. Now the intelligence of net wetware, because That's what they call us when they're making biological computers out of human parts, or out of biological parts for that matter, whether it be rat or human. Agabadi believes that harnessing the power and the efficiency of the human brain is the future of computing, and there are no practical limits on how large we can make our devices, like I've said before, that big pulsating brain in the sky, or how much we can engineer into neurons. I believe, as intelligent computation goes, biology is the ultimate frontier. He is not shy about his ambitions either. We want to be the Intel of wetware. So what is the future? Well, with 64 neurons, a drone can have a powerful sense of smell. But what is next? By Agabadi's approximation, a Kinoko chip with 500 neurons could then power a driverless car. 10,000 neurons could enable real-time image processing at the level of the human eye. And remember, DARPA just announced that they wanted to use DNA as a search engine. And with 100,000 neurons, it could enable robotics with multiple sensory inputs. Now remember, we have talked about that as giving computers senses like humans have, robot googly eyes, now robot sense of smell. And then we're going to have with some of these new high-end prosthetic devices, amputee arms and that are wired right into the neural structure. They're giving it a sense of touch, taste, smell, vision, hearing. Guys, we're going to be in big trouble. And when we can engineer a million neurons, it will actually give computers that can think for itself. So now let's think about this. There are 100,000 neurons in a piece of brain matter the size of a grain of sand. So it is not hard to see the potential here. Yet, there are sure to be significant challenges along the way. Yeah, like making sure that these 100,000 neurons aren't mentally ill. And we've read about some of those as well. They're the creative ones. There's much work to be done in attempting to build a brain-inspired machine, but that is very different than actually using biological matter like live neurons at a computing scale. And as magnificent as our advances in technology are, or scary, biology is far more advancing technology than anything ever created by man, and it is only in striving to replicate biological processes, ding, 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 and that is the key, just like the Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering. They are usurping nature to create technology that will overtake biology at some point in the future, that we understand how much we have to learn from nature's billions of years of evolution as we aspire to be gods. So that is the end of that story. So now let's get back to the Kinoko story, if I get back here. So this one was titled, Kinoko Core Fuses Live Neurons with a Silicon Chip to Sniff Out Bombs. And he is out of Tanzania. He spoke at a TED Global conference. And he is now looking at selling some of this technology for airport security. Of course he is. Because that's where the money is. Even these millimeter wave scanners that can use spectroscopy to see if there's any type of explosive material on your body. Or millimeter wave for naked body scanning, the stop and frisks that they are using in different places. You don't need to be using neurons to be able to do this. Agabadi explained that he and his team figured that a method of giving the neurons instructions in order to assign the system a particular task, like scoping out bomb threats in an airport, and in this particular context, the devices could be placed discreetly around a building, preventing the need for crowded security checks that we use today, right? 24/7 surveillance by these little living sniffers. The Kinoko Core was revealed publicly at the TED Global Conference in Tanzania, but images of this prototype device cannot be shared at the present time. Wink. However, Agabadi did show a video from the system being taken out of the lab setting and confirmed that in its current form, the living neurons can be kept alive for a couple of months in a normal environment, according to a report from the BBC. Other research teams apparently have been able to keep the neurons alive for as long as a year. So I wonder if this is part of that mini brain ball project. So this facet of the project should improve over time. And this device could also be used to, quote unquote, smell different diseases in a medical context. Yes, let's sell this as a 21st century cure or some sort of 21st century diagnostic. We'll put living cells in your next iPhone, reading the molecules given off by a person suffering from a particular condition. However, Agabadi has greater ambitions for the potential the technology has looking further forward. Quote, we think that the processing power that is going to run the robots of the future, that will replace you, will be synthetic biology based, and we are laying the foundations for that today, he says. The Kinoku Core is rather an amazing device in its own right, but the amalgam of living neurons and computer chips that underpins the project could have a profound impact as this technology matures. Yeah, well, you know what I have to say about that. So now there is another story here. If this page will load, because when I have an illness and I try to sing, I'm out of tune. All right. So this one is out of the Journal of Biotechnology and Biomaterials from September 29th, 2011. Titled Biological Computers, Their Mechanisms and Applications. Abstract. Biological computers are special types of microcomputers that are specifically designed to be used for medical applications. So not typically bomb sniffing. The biological computer is an implantable device. So look out for that one that is mainly used for tasks like monitoring the body's activities and inducing therapeutic effects at the molecular or even the cellular level. It is made up of RNA, DNA, and proteins, and it can also perform simple mathematical calculations. And this could enable the researcher to build an array or a system of biosensors that has the ability to target and direct specific types of cells that could be found in the patient's body. This could also be used to carry out or perform target-specific medicinal operations that could deliver medicinal procedures or remedies according to the doctor's instructions inside of your body. Yeah. Biological computers are a kind of biosensor which has emerged as an interdisciplinary field that draws together molecular biology, chemistry, computer science, and mathematics, and highly predictable hybridized chemistry of DNA is the ability to completely control the length and the content of the oligonucleotides and the wealth of enzymes available for modification of the DNA and make use of the nucleic acids as an attractive candidate for these nanoscale applications. Yes, and I'm going to add inside of you. These are mainly used for monitoring body's activities by inducing therapeutic effects, wink, at a molecular and cellular level. And biocomputing is one of those new fields of research, ding, ding, which deals with computer science and biology, but does not fit into both. A DNA computer has been used for the very first time to find the only correct answer from over a million possible solutions to a computational problem. And before one can turn a living organism into a computational system, biocomputing researchers need a way to create and connect multiple circuit switches, clocks, and so forth within a single cell. The researchers believe that the complexity of the structure of biological molecules could allow DNA computers to outperform their electronic counterparts in the future. And the idea of DNA computing came true for the very first time in 1994 when Alderman solved the Hamiltonian path problem using short DNA oligomers in DNA ligase. And in early 2000, a series of biocomputer models were presented by Shapiro and his colleagues who discussed molecular state finite automation in which the restriction enzyme FOLC constituted hardware, in short, DNA oligomers, where software as well as input-output signals and DNA molecules also provide an energy for this machine. And it's going to get a little too brain-boggling after that. So let's go to a motherboard story. We covered this one when it first came out, but it is good for emphasis. This is July 21st, 2016, out of motherboard.vice.com. Scientists build a biological computer where, inside of a cell. Yes, they did it. Chemically hacking bacterial DNA allows for a whole new world of biological computation. MIT engineers have developed biological computational circuits capable of both remembering and responding to sequential input data. And the group's work, which is described in this week's issue of Science, represents a critical step in the progress of synthetic biology with the integration of DNA-based memory. And in particular, pinpointing the way toward building large computational systems from biological components, computing devices that are living cells, and ultimately programming complex biological functions. More specifically, MIT's synthetic biology group was able to implement that within a living cell of what is known as a state machine, which is what we were just talking about. So a new state is always the result of an old state taken in combination with new inputs. And state machines happen to describe a very large number of things, from natural language processing algorithms to neurological systems to something as simple as a vending machine. Yeah, we're going to have biological vending machines in the future. All right, so now let's go to newscientist.com. Again, March 31st, 2016. Biocoding language now makes it easier to hack living cells, so they have actually decoded the language of cells. Tinkering with life just got a whole lot easier. Well, good thing. A tool that lets you design DNA circuits using a simple symbolic language makes programming living cells as straightforward as writing code for computers. The tools use an existing language called Verilog, which is used by chip designers to design electronic circuits. And the idea is to make programming cells more like programming a computer, and we take the very same approach as for designing an electronic chip, says Chris Voigt of MIT, and every step in the process is the same. It is just that instead of mapping circuits to silicon, you are mapping it to DNA. Synthetic biology aims to make it possible to treat cells as machines that can be engineered and programmed, and by altering a microbe's native DNA, it can be made to perform a specific task, such as producing a drug or changing color to detect a virus in your blood, and off-the-shelf genetic parts can be swapped in and out to make this lots easier, but it still can be a painstaking process. So then we ran across something we covered the other day. Organic computers made of DNA could actually process data inside of our bodies. Well, that's how we got to this point. And this was a newer story. I don't know where the date is. Again, they should put it right at the top here somewhere. Invariably imagine electronic devices to be made from silicon chips where a computer store and process information as binary digits, zeros, and ones. But it need not be that way. Among the alternatives to silicon are organic mediums such as DNA. So we have DNA computing, and it's come a long way. But since then, many DNA-based circuits have been proposed that implement computational methods inside of DNA and living circuits called molecular programming. This approach applies to concepts and designs customs to computing, to nanoscale approaches appropriate for working within DNA. Number one would be little DNA nanobots. DNA can also be used to control motion. And that would be also for DNA-based nanomechanical devices. In 2000, they created DNA strands from a pair of tweezers that opened and pinched closed, and later experiments demonstrated nanomolecular walking machines made entirely of DNA that could pick and lift and put down cargo with little hands and feet. And one possible application is that such nanorobot DNA walkers could progress along tracks, making decisions and signal when reaching the end of a track, indicating the computation has finished. But just as electronic circuits are printed onto circuit boards, DNA molecules could be used to print similar tracks arranged in logical decision trees on a DNA tile with enzymes that are used to control the decision branching along the tree. So maybe you could just plug it in. So this still isn't where I want to be, but we'll get there. Sorry, guys, I have a very long list of stuff to catch up on. So this one caught my attention. Living cell circuits could regrow organs and produce biofuels. Oh, so this is the money shot. Scientists have assembled a kind of organic circuit board for living computers by building logic gates within cells. It is no secret that computer circuits can process an enormous amount of information. Entire industries are built around this one core function of technology. But biologists will tell you that living cells process information too, and their process isn't a simple binary exchange of ones and zeros. Instead, cells deal with multiple complex structures of sugars, proteins, lipids, and DNA, and as such, the act of programming cells through genetic engineering is enormously complex, but that's okay, because scientists like a good challenge. Researchers at the University of Washington published in the journal Nature Communications, synthetic biologists announced a new method of turning organic cells into living computers. By installing the organic equivalent of a digital logic gate used in electronics, scientists can code instructions into cells so that particular inputs result in desired outputs. And instead of silicon and solder, biologists are using DNA and yeast cells to develop this new kind of organic processor. In a series of experiments, the University of Washington team built the largest organic circuit board constructed to date, including seven logic gates assembled in a series or parallel. And each gate consists of a gene with three programmable chunks of DNA. Two act as inputs, with a third as an output. Using CRISPR technology, these researchers program specific proteins to act as molecular gatekeepers, determining whether a particular gate will be active or not. If the gate is active, it sends a signal that deactivates another gate within the organic circuit, which means that scientists can basically wire together the gates to create logical programs in the cells. How long do you bet this is going to be before this gets into a person in a test as some sort of therapeutic cure? So this new research is a significant step forward for synthetic biology. Digital logic has been done at a very small scale with a few gates many times over the last decade or so, but our paper is the first to produce large circuits built in a eukaryote, which is a yeast, in which transcriptional machinery is considerably more complex. Eukaryote cells, like human cells, contain a nucleus and other structures that enable complex behaviors, and those are the kind of cells that we need to hack to do really useful things like regrow a liver, he says. Cells could be reprogrammed to undergo new development pathways to regrow organs or to develop entirely new ones. In such developing tissues, cells have to make complex digital decisions about which genes will express and when, and flipping switches on and off, and our technology could be used to control that process. So the organic circuit board could be used to produce viable biofuels, which require importing genes from several different organisms into a hybrid industrial strain. Yeah, so let's splice and dice them all together and see what happens. Those gene protein enzymes that each do a particular conversion of one molecule to another, and along a metabolic pathway that usually starts with sugar and ends with some sort of fuel. The trick is how to control that conversion process so it doesn't turn into a monster, I'm going to add, or some sort of bioweapon. The imported genes are usually not expressed at the proper levels, and the control logic that sets those levels or controls when a pathway turns on during fermentation is needed. and our large-scale circuitry could be used to implement that higher-level control. Such breakthroughs are way down the line, however, since we need DNA circuits with the power of a modern supercomputer, and right now we are dealing with the equivalent of those of the 1980s make-your-own-computer mail-order hobbyist kits. Well, I bet that won't be for too long. So now we find out that they are working on all kinds of things. DARPA is working on trying to turn DNA into a search engine. And they are looking at doing all kinds of different DNA experiments. And this one caught my attention from Microsoft Research. They are working on inching closer to a DNA-based file system. Oh, yes. Remember, DNA can store information for millions of years, especially if it's encased in glass. Microsoft Research adds the concept of random access to files stored in DNA. When it comes to DNA storage, efforts to give faster access grab most of the attention, but long-term archiving of data is equally important, and it generally requires a completely different set of properties. To get a sense of why getting this is right is important, just take the recently revived NASA satellite as an example. Extracting anything from the satellite's data will rely on the fact that a separate NASA mission had an antiquated tape drive that could read the satellite's communication software. One of the more unexpected technologies to receive some attention as an archival storage medium is DNA. And while it is incredibly slow to store and retrieve data from DNA, we know that information can be pulled out of DNA that is tens of thousands of years old. And there have been some impressive demonstrations of the approach, like an operating system being stored in DNA at a density of 215 petabytes a gram. And we also read about a tractor trailer full of DNA could store the entire contents of everything that has ever happened on planet Earth. We're going to turn into big hard drives of the future. But that method of treating DNA is a glob of unorganized bits, and you had to then sequence all of it in order to get any data from it. But now a team of researchers has figured out how to add something like a file system to DNA storage, allowing random access to specific data within a large collection of DNA. And while doing this, the team also tested a recently developed method for sequencing DNA that can be done using a compact USB device. Well, how nice is that? DNA holds data as a combination of four bases, and that would be A, T, C, and G. So storing data in a way that requires it translating bits of this into the system. Once a bit of this data is translated, it is chopped up into smaller pieces and inserted in between the ends that make it easier to copy and sequence. And those ends contain some information about where the data resides in the overall storage scheme. To restore this data, all the DNA has to be sequenced and the location information read and the DNA then decoded. And in fact, the DNA needs to be sequenced several times over since there are always errors and a degree of randomness involved in how often any fragment will end up being sequenced. Adding random access to the data would cut down significantly in the amount of sequencing that would be needed to be done. Rather than sequencing an entire archive of DNA to get one file, the sequencing could be far more targeted. And as it turns out, well, it is pretty simple to do. So note above where the data is packed between the DNA sequences, which makes it easier to copy and sequence, there are a lot more potential sequences that can fill the bill in terms of making DNA easier to work with. Researchers at Microsoft identified thousands of them, and each of these can be used to tag the intervening data as long as it belongs to a specific file, allowing it to be amplified and sequenced separately, and even if it is present in large mixtures of DNA different from the files. If you want to store more files, you just have to keep different pools of DNA, each containing several thousand files or multiple terabytes, and keeping these pools physically separated requires about a square millimeter of space. The team came up with a clever solution to the problem of DNA storage. Lots of digital files will have long stretches of the same data bits. Think of a blue sky or a few clouds a few seconds of silence in a music track. Unfortunately, DNA sequences tend to choke when confronted with long runs of identical bases. So to avoid this, the researchers created a random sequence and used it to do a bit flopping operation, which is an XOR with the sequence being encoded. And this would break up long runs of identical bases and pose a minimal risk of creating new ones. So it's meat and potatoes. So with something resembling a file system and a compact reader, we are moving close to the point where DNA storage is practical. Well, not quite exactly yet. The author points out the issue of capacity and our ability to synthesize data has grown at an astonishing pace, so don't write it off just yet. But it started from almost nothing a few decades ago, so it's still relatively small. But let Georgie Porgy Church keep working on it, assuming the DNA-based drives would be able to read a few kilobytes of data. The researchers then could calculate it would only take a few weeks to read every bit of DNA that could be synthesized annually. So put differently, our ability to synthesize DNA still has a long way to go before we can store much data. Well, phew. So that should make you feel better. So where do we go from here? I don't know. We got about a minute left. Here's one more. We're going to talk about the brain for a minute. Scientists just announced out of the University of Cambridge that graphene has now been shown to safely interact with neurons in the brain. Researchers have shown that graphene can be used to make electrodes that can be implanted in the brain, and it could potentially be used to restore sensory function for amputees or paralyzed patients, or also for individuals with motor disorders such as Parkinson's disease. Of course, it's all about curing you. Researchers have successfully demonstrated how it is possible to interface graphene, which is a two-dimensional form of carbon, with neurons or nerve cells while maintaining the integrity of these vital cells. The work may be used to build graphene-based electrodes that can be safely implanted in the brain and offers a promise for the restoration of sensory function or with individuals with motor disorders. Research was published in the Journal of ACS Nano, and it was interdisciplinary between the University of Trieste, Italy, and the Cambridge Graphene Center. All right, guys, try to have an awesome Wednesday, and I'll try to keep you in the